We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. This is a pre-recording of a Twitter Spaces live event that we hosted. If you'd like to be a part of the next one, go on to Twitter /Palisades Radio, and you can be part of the conversation. You can listen to our conversation on the desktop, but it works better on the mobile app. Just as a reminder, as always, you can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, as well as Odyssey if you don't enjoy using YouTube. I hope you enjoy it and hope to see you on the next one.
So what are we talking about? What are we talking about today? Everything and anything?
Everything and anything. I was thinking, I just went through one of your latest reports here, and it's interesting to, I just got finished doing another interview as well. Mm-hmm. with Gareth Soloway. And cool. He's a technical guy, and he was saying kind of one of the same things. Looking at the charts, he sees this as a good entry for silver. And in one of your recent articles here, you said why silver and silver investments are believed to be at a major or be at or close to a major bottom.
Right, right. But before you elaborate on that, just to be clear, that's a technical analysis report from a true technician. So I read it. I'm not saying that I necessarily agree with everything he's saying, but the author is very thorough. That's for sure. So yes.
Well, so what are your thoughts? Because obviously it's worth elaborating.
Why don't we just start with a trade? Okay. Meaning a very short term trade. 2 days ago for myself and a client, I bought silver and sold gold. Now, why did I do that? Very simply, I did that because I thought silver was undervalued relative to gold. But if something catastrophic happened, like, you know, precious metals all over the world are worthless, I wanted to make sure that I had some sort of a hedge. And it's something I've been watching for the last couple of years. So as a trade, 2 days ago, I bought silver and sold gold. I sold it out yesterday. The point being is I'm looking for re-entries on that. So from a short-term tactical thing, which is complementary with the technical stuff that we're both looking at, I like silver. But on a more ownership level, I like the reasons that silver is lower, meaning I'm not scared of it. Silver is lower because commodity trading advisors have been given the recommendation to sell it as a hedge for their stocks, and it's worked for them. Let's face it, under 22, it's been a home run for them. Also, I believe but cannot prove that somebody is selling more silver than they have any right to do because they're trying to keep a lid on metals while they accumulate gold. Sounds very tinfoil hat, but I've lived through it. It's real. It happened. So when you look at those two things, and I look at who's selling, meaning the CTAs, which are the this generation's version of the quote stupid retail. And when I say stupid, they make money. They're not geniuses, but they're making more money than we are right now. And I see who's buying, right? And here's the other side. So when I see who's buying, I don't know who specifically is buying, but I do know, and I mentioned this last time we talked, but it hasn't gone away yet. And it should be a bigger story. The spot silver price in London is higher than the COMEX silver futures. The first month future. Now, I don't want to be a broken record, but these things don't last long. And that says to me, without going too much down a rabbit hole, that says very simply, without being bullish or bearish, it says more people want silver now than they want 30 days from now. All right. So now when you extrapolate that a little bit, that simply means that people want their silver now, they can't wait. And then when you bifurcate it, meaning look at who is buying, which we don't know who's buying, and who is selling, which I do know who's selling. CTAs and short-term momentum funds that are enticed by the recent sell-off to sell in anticipation of further sell-offs, then I say, well, the very long-term dummies are selling. And the people that are buying physical, they're not buying it for a trade. That metal's not coming back on the market. So it's an old story. All the silver squeeze guys have heard it before. But you don't want to, I'm trading silver from the long side, and I also trade it from the short side. On a geopolitical or macroeconomic reason, you should be bearish because everyone else is selling it for that reason. But on a longer term reason, and no comfort for anybody who's long silver now and waiting for a pop, you should not be worried at all, because gold's being remonetized, and that means silver has to rally in price substantially once that remonetization becomes more official. Mm-hmm. That's why, for me, short story long, that's why I like silver. I will be a buyer of silver physically on a dip, right? But I like silver relative to gold now for a trade. So that's my answer.
Yeah, and it's so, I mean, there's so many different things that we, let's say the bearish case, if the world is going into recession because of the industrial demand portion of silver, that means that there's not going to be as much silver put into solar panels and all of the other industrial demands for it, right?
Right.
But that's more of a long-term play, and it's always important to be very specific about that timeline that we're talking about.
But right? Let me ask you a question, right? But isn't that the way it's always been? And everyone out there has to agree with me on this, I would think. Mm-hmm. But you and I both know that the story is that when there's a recession or the economy slows, there's less industrial demand for silver. And to the extent that silver is an industrial commodity, it will drop in price. Fine. I agree with that. Where's the other story? When the economy is doing well, there'll be more demand for silver and the price of silver goes up. Where's the flip side of that coin? We never get it. And that's because the market is, not to sound paranoid, but the market structure is broken and now breaking at the physical slowly, like nickel did its thing, natural gas is doing its thing. Silver won't do its thing quite like them, but it will be slow and painful and chronic, and eventually it'll resolve higher. Well, I guess what I'm saying is that there used to be tons of hedge funds that would speculate long silver. They're gone. They know the game is rigged. They're going to play something that's going to be allowed to move. And I don't mean like people are out there actively manipulating, although we know that they are. What I mean is the market structure doesn't lend itself to being long silver. The things are cooked against it. And so as a result of that, the natural long players in metals don't buy silver anymore. And I'll put a point, a very narrow point on this that makes it clear. Speculative and investment, not just speculative, investment hedge funds like to specialize, meaning when they want to own tech, they buy tech. They like what's called a pure play. If they want to own the strong economy, they want to buy duration, you know, which is a longer term tech company. If they want to buy bonds, they'll buy a pure bond. The financialization of the world has made it easy for hedge funds to really pigeonhole what they want. If I'm worried about inflation, I can buy TIPS, whether you believe that they work or not. If I'm worried about inflation, I can buy gold, although that hasn't worked, but I understand why. I'm not afraid of it. The point is there are so many specialized tools out there to do whatever you want that silver gets lost. Where it should be the Goldilocks asset in the world, meaning it's precious when we precious metals and it's industrial when we need industrial metals. It's not. It's neither. Okay. I think industrial metals are going to go up. Should you buy silver? Nah. Do a pure play. Do copper. Mm-hmm. I think precious metals are going to go up. Should I buy silver? Nah. Buy gold. If the economy's slow, silver won't work out. And so, you know, we're both looking at the glass, right? You and I are hedge funds, right? You trade oil. I trade silver. You say the glass is half full. I say the glass is always half empty. And it demoralizes the activity. And so the only people that are left buying now that have any staying power are the retail and the real secular structural holders of metal that are starting to buy right now. And those people, as long as they don't buy too much, that they have to sell it. You know, the Hunt brothers were leveraged, geared, however you want to look at it. They're fine. The question is, can you wait another 5 years? But I think it's, you know, look, I'm long silver right now, I'm naked, but that's a trade. I will get out of it in a week if I want to. Mm-hmm. But structurally, silver is a buy. Now, it doesn't mean that gold can go to $3,000 and silver only go to $30. But it does mean that 2 years from now, when gold is a part of, you know, whatever it is, an Eastern Europe basket of commodity currencies or a Western Bretton Woods type of thing, you can't keep the price of silver down when that happens, because then everyone will be buying silver as a proxy for gold. So hope that helps.
So, you know, you touched on an interesting point there, and I'd like you to elaborate on it a little more. You said a Western Bretton Woods. What do you think, there is a place for gold in a Western type, whatever type of currency that the West is going to go to, whether that's, you know, yeah, keeping, you know, the US dollar, or like, what do you think that looks like?
No, I hear you. I mean, it could play out. I mean, we're looking at a decision tree right here. I'm very confident that the end game is a complete, for a time period, a complete bifurcation of monetary systems. Meaning, in one way or another, there'll be an Eastern block of currencies and there'll be a Western block of currencies. Now, I'm simplifying it by saying East and West, but largely that's kind of what it looks like. All right. Mm-hmm. What that looks like will be natural resources, right? Everyone here pretty much knows the Exeter Pyramid. If you look at the Exeter Pyramid, what the Exeter Pyramid is, if you include natural gas and gasoline and oil and certain grains and gold and some silver in there and whatever else, iron, you know, those type of industrial, those are the bottom, not just gold, although gold is the tippy bottom, if that's a phrase. All right. So those are the foundation or the base that economies are made of. So you take that iron ore at the bottom of the pyramid and you learn how to smelt it, refine it, and you make steel. And you're moving up the pyramid now. And as you're moving up the pyramid, as humanity adds value to these natural resources, you get bigger wealth. You end up in a situation that we're in now, when you keep building on the bottom of the pyramid, that you end up with something like what Posar just recently said, $20 billion of natural gas in Europe translates into $2 trillion of economic wealth. Mm-hmm. So the leverage, if you look at the Exeter Pyramid, is more of a tree. Gold and the metals and oil are the roots, and the flower and the leaves are what we do with it. That's the top. Well, what's happened is the East feels that they've been getting the short end of the stick for far too long on their share of the world's wealth. They feel that they're getting pennies on the dollar for their natural resources, and they're not participating in the fruits of mankind's work as much. And that's, by the way, that's because of how we use the dollar as a weapon. And I'm not judging, I'm not anti-American here. I'm just saying this is what happens, right? This is what happens. The East is going on strike, right? The East is going on strike in more ways than one. And what they're saying is, we want a rebalancing of what we bring to the table. We think it's undervalued. And we can't do that because this dollar as a reserve currency gets in the way. So we're going on strike. That's what they're doing. They're going on strike. They're like labor going on strike, right? We're not gonna mine your metals or at least sell them to you anymore. So Now I come to your question. So the East says, we still need dollars if we want to buy Levi's. We still need dollars if we want to buy Harley Davidson, but we don't need dollars to do everything else. Simplifying it, obviously. And we don't need the West's financial instruments anymore. They're not letting us play to begin with. So we're going to do it on our own. They create an international trading type. And this is where I start to give my perception of how it will happen, as opposed to, I know this will happen, but here's how I think it could happen. So the East says, we're going to create an international trading currency. So they create a stable coin. The stable coin is what you would call the railroad tracks. They create railroad tracks, an alternative to SWIFT. And then they're going to say, what are we going to put in the stable coin? What are we going to put on the railroad tracks? What are we going to put for trade? And they'll probably have to negotiate. Okay, our total economy is, let's say, I'll make a number up, it's $1 trillion. Okay, of that $1 trillion, $200 million of that is made from natural gas. $500 million is made from oil. $150 million is made. And they'll create a basket with some sort of mix of economic weighted commodities, as well as, now this part isn't me making it up. I'm telling you what Zoltan was trying to explain. Economic mix of commodities weighed based on their currency. So it's kind of like, if oil is 80% of the ruble, their economy, let's just say it is, I don't know what it is, right? Well, selling oil is 80% of their economy, then we're going to put, and we're going to put 30% of the ruble in there, then we're going to have, you know, whatever, 24% of the economy of the global thing is going to be there. So the West, the East is going to do that, and they're going to create this trade bloc, and they're doing it right now. Like, more news came out on it today. Gold Telegraph had the post on the stablecoin. And I've been watching this stuff for a couple of years now, but they're releasing it now, but they've had this ready for a couple of years. So the East is going to start saying, okay, we will use dollars to trade with the West, and we will try and get rubles or yuan for our own services. You know, you want natural gas, pay us in rubles, pay us in yuan, or, you know, if we don't need them, we won't take them. You know, we just won't sell to you. But amongst themselves, they're going to create a more, in their opinion, egalitarian, fair to trade economic value with. Now, in the West, this is the more important part, I think. In the West, they're not asking the West, well, just say the United States. They're not asking the United States to be a part of that. They're saying, we're creating an alternative to the United States dollar reserve currency status. So what the United States says is the United States can go one of three ways, right? And the way that the extreme ways are, the hell with you guys, we're staying fiat. Now, you can't do that. You can't do that anymore if they're successful in establishing the Eastern Bloc physical currency, whatever they're going to call it. They'll call it the gold basket or something like that, the gold SDR, something like that. So they're not going to say no, but they're going to try and delay it as long as they can and even destabilize it. They're not going to go 100% yes, because that'll be undermining of their own debt, which is dollar denominated. So what they're going to do, now this is me completely making this up, but I've seen the pattern before. You want to protect the incumbent while you're building the replacement. You see it everywhere. Like on a trading floor, there used to be a floor, they create electronic trading, they don't let the electronic trading compete with the floor because the floor is where the money comes from, right? But the electronic trading is the future. Well, the dollar's where the money comes from, but this Bretton Woods 3 currency is the future. So you create a bifurcation, you create different rules, and you let them run side by side. I've really thought about this in other industries as well. And so that's how you do it. So you say, okay, you tell everyone dollars, 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 we're not going anywhere. Meanwhile, you're building these places like Fed Now, which will be launched in June of 23 or July of 23, will be the railroad tracks base infrastructure for the central bank digital currency. And eventually, so you're not going to say no, and you're not going to say yes. You're going to say no, but we're going to create this digital currency for domestic use only. Meanwhile, you're going to probably go to we've been talking about having a natural resource basket as part of the currency mix. Let's do that now. And the SDR will be created, and they'll probably weigh it with other currencies, decrease the dollar's amount, increase maybe by the actual commodity or a currency that's very heavy in the commodity. They will not, I believe this, they will not announce that gold is in the basket. Gold will not be in the basket, but countries that back their currency by gold will be in it. So in the old days, the Swiss franc. In the future, it'll be the yuan. And maybe some way down the road, 5 years from now, it's like the United States says, okay, we have this SDR, this IMF basket that we use for trade with Eastern European countries and for the Far East. And we have our fiat that we use domestically. And you end up having a system that's extremely similar to the mercantilist system that we had before World War I, which is you have your paper money, your bits of paper that you trade domestically. And you also have your current accounts where you offset gold and other commodities for your trade. And so you have two monetary systems. You have what governments trust each other with and what governments tell people to use. Does that make any sense? So we're going to end up with two currencies.
So maybe we can have Tom step in here and add how he sees that as well, because, you know, him and I have had a lot of good conversations around that.
Good afternoon, guys.
Hey, Tom.
So fascinating, really interesting take on this. It's interesting. I'm not listening to it and thinking, okay, am I on board with this idea or not? I think you're on, definitely onto something here. The thing that I've been thinking about recently is the following. and it popped into my head, especially with the FedNow announcement, which is that it's very clear from what I think are the very powerful central banks of the future. And I consider the Fed to be one of them. And I consider like the Monetary Authority of Singapore to be another and a few others, which is that they're all saying the same thing. There is no use other than the ECB. There is no use for a retail central bank digital currency. But there is kind of at the wholesale level, what BBL was just talking about. And effectively that we need some kind of update to SWIFT as a back end, as a payment layer amongst, you know, governments and amongst, you know, and amongst central banks and amongst, and really even amongst, you know, primary dealer banks, whatever. And I think that's what FedNow is ultimately going to be, because SWIFT is 60 years out of date and it needed to be replaced ages ago. And the Russians and the Chinese are clearly moving towards a monetary system that has a better, more technologically advanced back end. And even to the point of now with both Russia and the Iranians saying, we're going to take Bitcoin as a settlement currency for energy transactions. And then there's still the Fed paper that's out there saying, you know, Bitcoin plus Lightning Network, you know, is a really interesting problem. And I honestly think that in the long run, everybody's trying to figure out a way to stave off the reality, which is that, you know, the blockchain, which everybody in power from Jamie Dimon to they all say the same thing. We hate Bitcoin, but we love blockchain, right? Because blockchain as a technology is the thing that can help them replace SWIFT and modernize and then still maintain some control here. So I'm not worried about a central bank, a retail level digital dollar, because even Neil Kashkari came out and said, look, we don't need it. We already have a digital dollar. 95% of all dollars in the world are already digital ledger entries. And in many ways, encrypted databases are better than blockchains anyway. I wonder about that ultimately. The thing that I'm interested in, and speaking about the what's going on in the East, and the guy you want to watch on this is Sergey Glazyev. If you don't know who Glazyev is, former advisor to Putin, extreme Russian nationalist, and in many ways a hard currency kind of guy, and he's the one who's behind the entire idea of the Eurasian Economic Union commodity SDR concept. And this is something that he's been bitching at Putin about for 10 years to implement with Russia. And Putin rightly told him, no, the timing was wrong for this. His idea in the long run is correct, but it wasn't the right idea for, you know, when he was very close to Putin back in like 2012, 2013, 2014. And he's continually complains that Putin cost the Russian economy a few trillion rubles and losses from free floating the ruble. Yeah, you think so, Sergey? Like, you don't think that the New York boys and Europe and City of London wouldn't have bankrupted Russia had you tried to set the ruble to gold back then? No. What's happening now, it's very clear that those with that control the commodities are, like VBL said, I agree with this completely. They want to actually profit from the trade. The bigger question is, an entire producer's pyramid is collapsing. And we have been shoring up since 2008 the bottom of the Exeter's pyramid, which is based on gold and commodities and everything else. We've been trying to shore that up with base money, with M0, by stuffing the banks full of reserves and all of that stuff in order to try and keep the pyramid from toppling over and just kind of widening out the base. And we had one of two ways we could do that. We could either do that by allowing the price of gold to rise and thereby allow the entire pile to rise, but it would have had to have risen 10, 15, 20, 30 fold, or we expand, as Luke Roman has pointed out many times, we expand the amount of paper gold that's out there. And that's what we've done. We've chose that path, and that path has reached its end. So I don't know. I think that, you know, this
if,
is all.
If I can interrupt you for just a sure. second, Tom, why do you think that path has risen or has reached its end of expanding that amount of paper gold?
Well, because at some you don't there's not enough le- there's not you don't have a you don't have any more debt that you can credibly service based on the pile of financialization. Because remember that when leverage is 8-to-1, it's manageable. When leverage is 200-to-1 or 300-to-1, it's not. And then we get into the situation we're in today, where the Russians say, well, that's nice, but you need to have rubles or gold or whatever in order to buy our oil or buy our gas. The European Union's response to this is, fine, we won't buy it from you. Okay, well, then you get to start or you get to freeze. And that's what Putin literally said, what, this morning. So I think that, you know, at a certain point, as always, the Misesian, Austrian critique of leverage is the correct one. That eventually you run out of other people's money to lever up, and that we've used the financialization, and not just domestic dollars, but I'm talking now in the international use of dollars to set and to control the price of physical commodities through futures manipulation. And we're seeing this to a degree I've never seen before across multiple markets now over the last 3 or 4 months since the G7 meeting, to set the price now of oil, not just silver and gold, which were easy because no one really cared about them, but now oil and just about anything else, lumber, cows, you know, meat. We're seeing it everywhere. We've seen it for years where the commodity producers were being held, where all the profit was being sucked out of the supply chains for base commodities through the financialization and the leverage implicit in all of these, or explicit in all of these, in all of these markets. And we went along with that because we could. We could get away with it. We can't get away with it anymore. Okay. Because they broke the supply chains. They've broken globalization. And now we're staring at the comeuppance, which is that for what, 5 years now, we've been trying to push the price of the ruble down to destabilize the Russian government and create domestic inflation, while at the same time trying to keep the price of oil up in order to support the idea that, you know, we're running out of oil. Like it's nonsense. And so, you know, eventually these two things have to, that system has to break, and the Russian ruble has to obviously rise if the price of oil is going to be held at $90 a barrel. Now they want to bring the price of oil back $1 a barrel. But I was doing this the other day. I was looking at some of this stuff, and I said, you know, the main reason why the West wants to only pay $50 or $60 a barrel for oil is because that's what the Chinese and the Indians are paying. Especially when you normalize, certainly for the Indian rupee, you normalize the Russian ruble versus the Indian rupee pre and post war. I did this analysis the other day for my patrons. It's clear that, you know, the ruble strengthened versus the rupee by 25%, which is of course why the Russians are selling their oil to them at 25% off. The Indians are paying the same price that they were before. Europe wants that price, and they're not going to get it. And they really did think that they had, you know, I've always said they always thought they had monopsony power over the price of Russian oil, and they don't, because they didn't expect anybody else to go along with them. So yes, we're going to have a bifurcated system. Yes, we're going to have a lot of two-tiered monetary systems. The Russians are going to wind up with a two-tiered monetary system similar to China's. And I don't know that we wind up with that here in the United States, but for me, I think we've run this financialization model so far that at some point, okay, if the financialization model is now going to collapse, if leverage is coming out of the system and the flow of dollars around the world is coming out of the system, and as you and I, Tom, we've talked before, Powell's mm-hmm. even said there's room in the world for more than one reserve currency, and you know the U.S. Treasury as a percentage of global reserves is down to 59% from 71% when Lehman Brothers fell. And this has been a slow, steady, you know, democratization of global reserves. That should start to accelerate now once we get past this, what I consider a kind of biblical dollar short squeeze, right, as the Fed aggressively raises rates here. That's going to end very soon. And then at some point, we're going to wind up with a reckoning at a political level for the United States as to how we're going to deal with an overly strong dollar. And then that becomes, I think, sets the stage for what the Fed does next or what America does next. And right now, as you and I've talked about in multiple venues, I do believe that there's not consensus at the top of the U.S. political and economic oligarchy, for lack of a better term, as to which way we should jump. And I firmly believe that, for example, that, you know, President Biden, you know, using that term loosely, doesn't work for American purposes. He works for European purposes, not Chinese either. He works for the Europe in order to keep them from imploding. And the Fed is beginning to work for the United States as opposed to being the central bank of the world. And I just think there's a lot of confusion the way the market's operating right now, because we've always been used to the Fed acting as the world's central bank. And I think that people are having a hard time shifting their focus on this. But I think it's very clear the way the Fed is acting that that's what's happening.
So as we talk about this bifurcation of the two, you know, reserve currencies over the world, or this real separation of the world into two different parts, is there any interest, let's say, in the West of trying to be accommodative to that system, do you think? Or is it just an attitude that they're going to have to keep bringing forward against the East once this, you know, whatever you want to call it, let's say this BRICS right. plus currency really starts to take off?
I think that the Fed is a lot less antagonistic towards this idea than a lot of people want to believe. Mm-hmm. I think the Fed understands that it's time for the dollar to end as the world's quote unquote singular reserve currency. I think Powell's made this abundantly clear. I think our banking system doesn't survive if we continue it. I think our country as a 50-state political compact doesn't survive this. I think, you know, it's done. All the things that we've all been saying in the cold community for God knows how long now, we're here, we're in it. And now the question is it shifting? And so I think the Fed in many ways welcomes this, because they no longer have the burden having to worry about, you know, what those emerging markets are going to do. And, you know, you can be as generous or ungenerous or cynical as you want about what the Federal Reserve is or is not. But there comes a point when there's no more blood to be extracted from the stone. At some point, you have to admit that. And now you have to get your own house in order. And I really do believe that we're at that point. There's nothing else you can do how much more wealth are you going to extract from your middle class, right? Mm-hmm. How much more without literally destroying the entire structure of your fabric of your society? Now, if that's your goal, well, then, okay. Now, whose goal is that? It's not the Fed's, but it's explicitly the goals of the European Commission, the European Union, the World Economic Forum, as a proxy for people standing behind them. And this is why I've been thoroughly focused on this idea that this is really about old colonialist money in Europe not wanting, and I don't think they're going to give up until they're removed from the system. They're bankrupted. And I think the way you bankrupt them is you bankrupt Europe, because that's where their power really is. So I think that there are American forces that understand the value of commercial banking, right? They don't want to do away with that. And a retail central bank digital currency is anathema to the concept of central bank of commercial banking. So, I mean, everybody's incentives kind of map out pretty obviously that we can have a bifurcated system. Gold or commodities can be a common denominator. And I think at some point, again, to VPL's point, but I think I differ in what I think I see in the future. And I say this knowing that, and I brought this up before, that when Trump was talking about 50 and 100 year bonds when he was in office, the thing that was not talked about openly was that they wanted to tie those 50 or 100 year bonds to a portion of the payback, right, when the bond matures, would be a claim on Treasury gold if you wanted it to. So that's how I think the United States is going to quote unquote remonetize gold. That's how they're going to get out of. That's one path, and it's a good path for us getting out of the massive amount of entitlement, or the arrears that, you know, our balance of payment problem that we have long term, our liabilities, right? So, is that we'll be able to, if the Fed does its job, which is right now, it's not raising rates to tame inflation. It's raising rates now the same way Volcker did after Arthur Burns left, which is to restore confidence in the U.S. dollar as a currency, you know, worth investing in, and a country. And the U.S., a country worth investing in. Meanwhile, the Biden administration is doing everything imaginable to break that down. So that tells you who each one works for. Then, you know, once you have that in place, it's pretty obvious that the path here is for the Fed to want to have some form of remonetization of gold and use that big freaking pile of gold that we have as a real asset, as opposed to holding it at $42.22 an ounce on the balance sheet and discounting it. Meanwhile, you know, other central banks that are who think they're powerful, i.e. the ECB, marks their gold to market, is now sitting on a pile of European debt which is falling in price by the day, especially as the Fed raises interest rates. And even if credit spreads between Germany and US, the US don't collapse, for example, as long as the Fed keeps raising rates, your German debt has to fall in value. Well, that's eroding the ECB's balance sheet. So, of course, the ECB today wants a higher price of gold, which is what all the new Basel III rules were all about. This is the way I see this layout. And then, you know, and we're going to find out what the real price of oil actually is. We're going to find out the real price of all these commodities are. And I just see that we're going to have an I continue to think that we're going to have an expansion of commodity value as the bottom of extra pyramid gets bigger, as VBL pointed out, and the financialization froth of the top of extra pyramid collapses. It's the same argument that was going on in 2008 between Peter Schiff and Harry S. Dent. If you guys remember those arguments, the debates that went on between those two guys back then. And one was arguing pure inflation, one was arguing pure deflation. And I don't remember you guys, but I remember sitting here screaming at my friggin' internet connection going, dude, it's going to be half, it's going to be a little bit of both. Like, that's literally what I was doing when ensconced in my laboratory. When I, at the time, I was a chemist at the time. And I'm like, but I was screaming at the, at, you know, like listening to these guys like argue on Jim Pavlova's whole show and saying this exactly. I still think that's what's going to happen now. And I see that's where we're headed in the future.
Vince, is there anything you wanted to add there, Keith?
I definitely want to jump in at some point.
Yeah, just so you know, I'm done with my rant now. I got about 15 minutes before I need to leave, so I'm happy to field a couple of to go back and forth on this. So that'd be great. I just wanted to let you know I only have about 15 minutes or so.
Keith, I'll just add. I just want to add one color piece to what Tom said, and then I'll be quiet. I hear what you're saying, and I am being a little conspiratorial in terms of the monetary central. There's no need for digital dollars in the U.S. I understand that, but I do believe ideologically, not at the Fed level, but more at the neo-Keynesian level, they believe if you're going to get MMT to work, you need CBDC. And MMT wants to obviate, right? Right? And MMT,
agreed.
I'm not saying that they will.
Completely.
And I'm not saying it, but I am, you know, maybe I'm being a little bit tinfoil hat, but that's true. The thing I wanted to add was fascinating because I never heard it before, but it immediately clicked something to me. When you said one of the ways that they could possibly remonetize gold would be to attach it to a bond, throw it out on the yield curve and say, we'll pay you on the back end, which I think is actually brilliant.
It's Judy Shelton's.
Okay.
She threw this out there on a podcast with Grant Williams a few months ago.
Oh, it's fucking brilliant. Excuse my
French. Of course it is.
Here's why it's brilliant. What's old is new again. When I started in the business, which was right after the 87 crash, everyone had a commodities desk I was at Lehman, right? I was in resale research and everyone had commodities trading desk. You know, you had your softs desk, you had your grains desk. Gold did not have its own desk.
Nope.
Gold was on the bond desk because gold is, as and will be again, money. And if you're going to price gold, you have to know what the yield curve's doing. You have to know what the term structure is doing. And gold was always traded by the bond guys, even after they demonetized it. And to your point, indirectly, 6 months ago, I started telling people, you know what? I'm starting to see the bond guys from my contacts speculate on gold again. And they hadn't done that. They hadn't done that since Clinton was in office, Tom. And I'm like, holy shit. So when you said that to me just now, I'm like, oh shit. Bond guys understand gold. And it goes all the way back to if you're gonna settle you settle your debts in gold, you throw your gold out on the yield curve. And by the way, that's their habit, right? Defer what you can for as long as you can, especially if you're the incumbent, which is the US. And so I wanted to add that color to what Tom said because it's a fascinating point. Because how do you remonetize gold without having a knee-jerk impulsive reaction? Well, you throw it out on the yield curve. You tie your bonds to it. And an important accounting feature that I want to reemphasize that Tom said is we carry it on our books at cost, for lack of a better word. Europe carries it on their books at mark to market. So we're pretty good at cooking the books on gold lower because we don't want anyone to enjoy that advantage until we enjoy it.
VBL, you're absolutely correct. And that's why I think that at some point everyone's going to freak the fuck right out when the Fed wants the price of gold to rise, but it's not now. It right now they have a political fight they have to fight against Capitol Hill. They have to gut the commies and the MMTers on Capitol Hill.
That's right. That's right. And I know recently you turned, not that you were anti-Powell, but you turned more friendly to Powell. And, you know, when I read something that you wrote about that, I had been for the last year researching what Burns did versus what Volcker did. And I found the nexus. The Burns-Volcker nexus was in 1979, Burns gave a speech and it was basically a laundry list of everything he did wrong. But what he was doing was he was giving cover from Volcker to do what he needed to do. He's like, we need to ignore this, ignore that, ignore this. And Volcker went out of there in September of 79. And in October, he just started skyrocketing rates. And at the time, my read on it was, oh, Powell will never be Volcker. Powell will be Burns. And I was, you know, dogmatically clinging to that. And then I came to a conclusion for different reasons. I was like, you know what? Powell's not going to pivot. He's got to get us at least two or three inflationary reports that are lower.
Yep.
And so and then when Jackson Hole, he only used 8 minutes, he kept the market guessing. I said, oh shit, he really does give a shit about inflation. And I'm not saying that he's a patriot. I'm thinking a little bit more Machiavellian. He's worried about his, he doesn't want to be Burns. He wants to
he said that explicitly. The other thing that Keith, once we're done with this, I'll be happy to field a couple of questions for me. Remember, Daniel DiMartino Booth has been making this point explicitly clear, which is that Powell has said explicitly, I do not want to be Arthur Burns.
Right.
Now, but moreover than that, I also don't believe I don't believe he's a patriot. I just believe he's doing what he's supposed to do. He works for the New York banks. Specifically, he works for the New York banks, the major shareholders in the New York Federal Reserve.
Right. And don't want to go out of business with CBDC. I hear what you're saying. Right.
And now there are some of them that do. And you can see it from I think it's Bank of New York Mellon. I think it's BOFA. I think it's everybody who showed up at Davos 2022 this year.
Right, right, right.
Okay. And the ones that didn't show up at Davos 2022 this year, JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Wells, Citigroup, I think those are the ones we should be focusing on and asking good questions about what their moves are. Remember, I really have to protect my board game night because it's like my thing. I'd love to be here all night doing this shit, but it's important to me that I get away from this crap for a few hours every week. And I'd love to actually, you know, sit down and chat without any of you guys on another podcast and another venue. But this is what I'm saying. I just think that Powell's acting in their best interest. I think that there are very powerful commercial banking interests and regional banking interests here in the United States that are putting pressure to say no to a central bank digital currency. And there's no need for it. Absolutely. Right. And I think the people who need it are the ones who are the net energy importers now, Europe. The people who don't want a carbon fuels based future are the ones that don't have any carbon based fuels that they want to burn.
Right.
That's simple.
That's awesome.
So, all right. So, Keith, you had a couple of questions?
No, I wanted to offer my own take on the whole thing.
All right.
Not a question per se.
All right. Well, then why don't I've dominated for about half an hour. I'm going to go. You guys enjoy and have a great afternoon. Thank you for the invite, Tom, as always.
Just before you go, I did get a question here that I'd like you to. It was kind of directed at you. So
okay.
I'd like to get your thoughts on it real quick and then very happy to move on and get your take on it, Keith. The question is basically, what amazes me is that there is a complete lack of civil action against the JP Morgan gold trading boss and especially his employer following the recent jury decision against them. The guilt is established and neatly wrapped up for the civil litigants. There is no shortage of rich investors who could stick a pin in this illegality, especially out of the litigious USA and America's JP Morgan. Why is there no civil class action?
That's a good question and I can't answer it for you, but I'm going to note for you is that JP Morgan was convicted in a federal court in Illinois, which is Obama's backyard, not in the Southern District of New York, which is JP Morgan's backyard. That's the best I got for you other than, let's see what happens.
Perfect. Thanks, Tom. Really appreciate it.
Thank you guys. Have a great afternoon, everyone.
Pin in on what you just asked, Tom.
Sure.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jim.
First of all, two things. JP Morgan was party to a lawsuit. They were the defendant to a lawsuit that people tried to have a class action lawsuit, traders, probably 7 or 9 years ago. Okay. They found not enough evidence to convict him. That's number one. Number two, in this last litigation, JP Morgan was adjudicated. They paid, I believe it's $920 million fine. I don't have evidence that they paid the fine. That's what the verdict was, the way I understand it. And I believe they've got a deferred prosecutorial action lodged against them in case they get caught doing it again. That was more on the spoofing issue. And then that was litigated, I believe, in 2020, and they paid the fine. And then the traders have been in the news recently because two or three of the top traders, I believe one was found innocent, two of the three people were found guilty of like 11 of 13 accounts, I believe, something like that. But to answer what Tom couldn't answer, JP Morgan did have from traders, silver traders from, let's say, you know, 2000 to 2010, 2013, they were found not guilty. There wasn't enough evidence to convict them.
Thanks, Jim. I remember listening to, or I think you and I maybe discussed that before, that it was just, it's almost impossible to, and I'm sure Keith, you'll have a good amount of stuff to say on that as well, right?
Yeah, so I want to touch a couple of topics, and then I want to talk about you know, the idea of a gold standard or gold-backed currency versus other commodity currencies. First thing I wanted to touch on was this idea of strip mining the middle class and the so-called wealth effect. For some reason, they invited me to the Manhattan Institute, put on a, was the host for something called the Shadow Open Market Committee. So the monetarists who, you know, give friendly criticism to the Fed, I'll put it that way. Hey, you guys missed an opportunity to hike rates 25 bips, you know, 3 months ago. Get with the program, you know, that kind of thing. And for some reason, they invited me, the lone gold guy in the room. They had Dick Fisher as the keynote speaker, who at the time was the president of the Dallas Fed. And I don't remember at all what he talked about. It was completely inane. But I do remember one question during the Q&A, someone asked him about the effect, which is, I think, what we're referring to with all this. So he, you know, spreads his arms wide, palms out, and says, let me just say, the wealthy have been very affected. And everybody in the room gave that golf clap, you know, because the room was full of either one percenters or there's a revolving door between academia, where people get prestige, the banks where they get money, and working for the Fed or the Treasury where they get power. And I guess the way you're supposed to plan your career, if you're that sort of person, is you go through that revolving door a few times, and then you end up as, you know, chairman of the Fed, or at least president of one of the regional banks or something. And then you're rich and you have prestige as an academic, and you know, you have power in the Fed. And that's what those people are after. And I remember sitting here thinking, you son of a bitch. You think that what you're engineering is a great looting of the poor and the middle class and feeding yourselves. And everybody in the room was giving a little polite clap to that. Of course, it's actually worse than that. Think about this for a minute. They don't have any wealth. That's why they're the poor. So if you just suddenly got trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars richer, it didn't come out of the pockets of the poor. They didn't have anything even before you started. Mm-hmm. That's number one. Number two, the middle class, to the extent they are middle class, also feels richer in this so-called wealth effect because they have stocks in their 401ks and they have real estate. So the middle class, to the extent they have assets, feel richer, and the rich feel richer. Where is, you know, it's like one of those mystery books. Where is all this wealth coming from? And the answer is, it's not coming from, it isn't actually wealth, it's the wealth effect. The Fed can't engineer wealth, but they can engineer a rise in asset prices, and everybody who owns assets, from the middle class to the rich, feels richer to the extent they have assets, especially on leverage. Middle class owns their houses typically with leverage, so they feel a lot richer. Everybody feels richer. Of course, the whole thing is a mirage, an illusion. No one's actually getting richer. So it's actually much worse than what Dick Fisher imagined it to be when he was so magnanimous and just, you know, so bemused by the whole little thing that he had done. I wanted to touch on manipulation for those. So Ted Butler, I want to say this is 2015 or 2016. It's years ago now, put out a piece in which he basically said, look, I'm kind of emeritus. I've done my life's work. I've shown everybody the manipulation, blah, 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 blah. He kind of recapitulated his arguments. And he said, I welcome anyone with thoughtful disagreement. Mm-hmm. So I wrote
you,
a piece.
You and I have touched on this, I think, almost every time we've spoken.
Yeah. But for the benefit of the listeners here, so I wrote a piece I wrote a piece called Thoughtful Disagreement with Ted Butler. And that was an opportunity to publish, you know, pretty much since my economics work and my dissertation work going back to 2009, 2010, 2011, I've been developing a theory and then a model and then the data science and then ultimately the software to measure all kinds of things going on in the gold and silver markets. So we published the gold forward rate, the gold lease rate, all kinds of things that the LBMA stopped publishing when they were under regulatory compliance pressure in 2015. So anyways, that article was the opportunity to publish a bunch of data that we had, which is we could see how every gold and silver future behaved, 130 some odd contracts, going back to 1996. And in that article, I said, okay, we have two competing theories. If this were science, if this were Einstein versus, I don't know, Lorentz, scientists would be looking for a corner case where the theories predict opposite outcomes, and then they would aim their telescopes or whatever, or you know, their particle colliders to try to find an example where that corner case is occurring to figure out which behavior is actually happening, and then, you know, determine which theory is right and which one is wrong. So that's what I did in that article, and I believe I proved with the data that it isn't manipulated. For anybody who's interested in that, it's Thoughtful Disagreement with Ted Butler. That made the rounds. I mean, Gata published it, the Metropole Cafe published it, Zero Hedge published it, 24 Hour Gold, every, you know, gold site, Kitco, big and small, published it. It was getting a lot of buzz, you know, at the time, and it kind of lingered for a few months. I became a one word name on Gata, where they said what Wiener doesn't want to know, or something like that, is what they said. That's interesting. I'm a one word, you know, one word game now. So that was, you know, I arrived. But that's the first thing I wanted to say. The JP Morgan spoofing thing, you know, a lot of people are using that as example of this manipulation, and I want to make the argument that this is an example of what's called the Mott and Bailey fallacy. And the fallacy is named after kind of this medieval fortification where you have the Mott, which is very defensible. That's that round keep tower, which is extremely defensible. You're not going to get people out of that very easily. Or certainly, you're going to kill a lot of your own troops trying. But inside the Mott is very cramped, very small, as you can imagine, with all the people and all the animals and all the defecation. It becomes very unpleasant, especially in the summer. And so where people want to be is the Bailey, which is a much larger, that's kind of the little town or the village outside of the Vermont. And then that is only protected by like a wooden stockade fence. So the Bailey is where you want to be, but it's indefensible. The Mott is where you don't want to be, but it's highly defensible. And so as a form of argument, people make an indefensible statement. The price of gold would be $50,000 an ounce, but for this incredible manipulation, which has been going on for at least 3 or 4 decades, and the powers that be don't want to let gold, blah, 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 blah. That is the Bailey. That's what everybody wants to believe, but it's completely indefensible. So the Mott form is, look, a JP Morgan trader and his boss just got criminal, or I guess the one guy, now the boss is on trial next. The one JP Morgan trader just got criminally convicted in Illinois for manipulation, something, something, something. Now, he didn't get manipulation for keeping the price of gold down from $50,000 to $1,700. He got criminally convicted for spoofing. That is, for putting in orders that he canceled before it could be filled. And the whole crime of spoofing depends on proving that it was his intention to when he placed the order, was not to actually have it be fulfilled. which is, I don't know how you prove such a thing. I think it's kind of a non-objective law. But anyway, that's the law. That's what he got convicted of. Now, spoofing is something, and the actual court filings show that the spoofers made money in both directions. That is, sometimes they pushed the price up in order to make a tick, and sometimes they pushed the price down and made a tick. So it was a non-directional thing in which they're basically stealing pennies from high-volume traders. So the people that were hurt by this weren't the long-term buyers and holders of gold and silver. It was the people that are trading frequently, arbitragers trying to do carry trades and whatnot, where the spoofers were taking fractions of a penny from them. So anyways, I don't want to dwell on manipulation too much. I'll add one other thing to it. In a certain sense, gold and silver are extremely manipulated. We live in a world in which, by law, we demonetized gold and silver. And since then, we have government schools, which is plank number 5 from the Communist Manifesto, by the way. We have government schools that are teaching children from a very early age that money means pieces of paper with green ink on it, or increasingly digital bank digits. If you go and do a Google Images search and type in the word money, you will see page after page after page of paper with green ink on it. People holding fistfuls of cash and, you know, pictures of printing presses and fresh sheets of dollar bills. You will not see a single gold coin anywhere. So in a certain sense, everybody has been trained, the gold bugs first and foremost, that money means the dollar. Dollar is the unit of measure. Gold and silver are things that go up and down. And the purpose of gold and silver is to trade to make real money, which is dollars. Everybody believes that. I'm like the lone guy saying that's not really right. And I've built up quite an enemies list in the gold community for saying that. Anyways, moving on from manipulation, somebody mentioned Basel III and asserted that the purpose of Basel III is to get the price of gold up. There's a fundamental misunderstanding of Basel III. People say that Basel III declared gold to be a tier one asset, which is one of those things. Michael Crichton was talking about the Gell-Mann amnesia effect. And, you know, this is this idea that people read something in the newspaper, which gets things not only wrong, but backwards. And, you know, realize that the newspaper has no idea what the hell they're talking about on that one topic, but then blissfully turn the page and they assume on the next page the newspaper knows what the hell they're talking about. And he uses the phrase, wet streets cause rain, for something that's not even wrong. So in the world of banking, tiers, as in tier one, does not refer to the asset that the bank buys. It refers to the capital that the bank raises in order to be a bank in the first place. So tier one is on the liability side of the bank's balance sheet, not on the asset side of the balance sheet. And gold is not a source of funding. Banks do not raise gold capital. As far as I know, there's only one entity in the world right now that raises gold capital, and that's Monetary Metals. The banks are definitely dollar funded. What Basel does is it says the banks have to have an increased net stable funding ratio for gold. So Basel is trying to look at what are the risks in another 2008 type crisis. And there's a risk that your assets go down because of either market volatility or because of defaults in a stress condition. There's also a risk that your funding goes away. If you're funding yourself in the overnight funding market, let's say demand deposits, in the 2008 crisis, that could go away. So what they're saying is gold is so risky. Gold is so risky, according to Basel III, that you need to have 85% of your funding be either long-term bonds or equity capital. So Basel III makes it more onerous for banks to own gold. And I think the easiest way to explain it to a layman, it increases the opportunity cost for a bank to own gold. It makes gold relatively less attractive for a bank to own. And this includes gold receivables, gold loans to mining companies, for example, gold leases to refiners, for example, become relatively less attractive for the bank to have on their balance sheet versus conventional paper assets. So Basel is if somebody wanted to design a way to encourage banks to bid up the price of gold, Basel III would be the exact opposite of what they would enact in order to do that. Oh, the idea of gold backing. We as a civilization have kind of lost some of the concepts that would have been so pervasive that nobody necessarily would have written down what it was. Like, imagine archaeologists you know, 10,000 years from today, looking back at our civilization, they're not exactly going to find a lot of literature on, you know, what a drive-through window is, you know, or that sort of thing. It's so ubiquitous that everybody would know what it is, that nobody's writing magazine articles, let alone scholarly papers on drive-through windows. And, you know, back in the 19th century, everybody understood that when you made a deposit of money at the bank, that was a deposit of metal, specifically. The money referred to the metal, and that you got a piece of paper, whether that was a passbook or whether that was a currency note, you got a piece of paper that was evidence of the deposit and basically a mini contract that gave you the right to demand the redemption of your metal. You owned it. It was a credit relationship, but for purposes of shortening this, you had this metal at the bank and you had the right to demand it at will. It was a demand deposit. And so then you present that, and the bank had to, you know, they would obviously have a small amount in the vault, but if there was a lot of redemptions going on, the banks would have to sell assets, which were gold-denominated assets in those days, in order to raise the gold, in order to pay out the redemptions. That's been lost today. So when people talk about we're going to have a gold-backed currency today, or better yet, a currency backed by a basket of other commodities, you've got two different problems here. The first is that non-money commodities cannot be used as a currency. Think about it for a minute. If let's say I owe you, and to leave out the money terms, I owe you enough value to buy, let's call it a near luxury car, you know, a fully loaded, you know, Honda Accord or kind of a low to midline Infiniti. I owe you that much value. If I'm going to pay you that in oil, you would need, and I, you know, the price of oil has been all over the place recently, but something like a decent sized swimming pool, like bigger than what you get in a typical backyard in a typical residential house. You'd need a pretty big swimming pool to hold that much oil. And of course, oil is smelly and toxic, and it breaks down when it's exposed to oxygen and sunlight. It's volatile, it's flammable. There's all kinds of regulations around it. Very few people actually have the capability to hold and store oil. So it becomes a real problem. There is no practical way for 99.99% of the people on the planet to demand payment in oil. Cotton would be similar. I mean, you get all those cotton fibers in the air. That's actually an explosion risk, or grain. I know it is with grain elevators. You know, when you look at all the other commodities, there were real logistical and practical problems with anybody trying to demand delivery, not least of which is the incredible bulk and weight. You know, so copper doesn't have the problem of being toxic or volatile, but there's a lot of bulk and a lot of weight. Gold, $1,700 an ounce. Copper, which is, you know, less than half the density, so twice the bulk for the same, $4 a pound. You need an enormous amount. You need a garage full of copper, you know, pallet after pallet after pallet of the copper ingots, to be that same amount of value that I could give you a gold bar the size of the large format iPhone for that same amount of value. So these other commodities don't really work, and you know, as any kind of backing. If backing is to mean redeemable, if backing is to mean that you have the right to walk in and say, I'm done holding this currency, I actually want the underlying commodity now, gold and to some degree silver are the monetary metals for a reason. They're the practical ones to actually take demand of. All the other commodities just don't work as you look at the physical and practical realities of it. A lot of people use the term backing to mean something else. They don't mean, well, that you would literally go to the bank and demand redemption. They just mean it in the sense of there's some sort of board, some sort of control board or a planning board, currency board, that is going to look at the prices of all these commodities trading in the market and somehow manipulate their money or their currency so that the price of the currency stays within a band as denominated in their currency. Now, the problem with that is, number one, you have a central planning board. Problem number two is, who the heck trusts that that board is going to hold the line when the chips are well and truly down? That board is appointed by politicians. So that's Joe Biden and McCain and Trump and everybody that you may or may not like, appointing various members of that board over the years. And that board is full of people that have their own economic interests, their own portfolios, their own friends and cronies. When the chips are really down and there's really stress or crisis in the system, are they going to actually hold the line on that? Or are they going to declare a revaluation? Well, yeah, we know our currency used to be backed by one egg and two chickens and three cows. But, you know, the price of eggs has gone up so much that we're going to now back it instead by a stick of margarine and a moldy piece of corn and half a pig instead of two cows. Is that okay? So nobody's going to trust that, number two. And then number three, we don't have the means of controlling the prices of those commodities in terms of their currency anyway. It just simply isn't true that, well, if you double the money supply, you're going to double the price of all those commodities. And suppose the price of the commodities goes up, it certainly isn't true that if you unprint, you know, half of your money supply, that the prices of the commodities will fall in half. And anyways, you don't really have a means of unprinting. The Fed right now is trying to tighten. That's the closest thing we have to unprinting today. I don't think very many serious people think that the Fed will get anywhere near having their balance sheet, let alone having M1 or M2, you know, measure of money supply, let alone M3. You know, at best, if you look at 2008, the measures of the money supply went down by, you know, almost immeasurable little dips before skyrocketing up on higher. So that's not a viable monetary system anyways. Finally, I want to add, in an actual gold standard, as it evolved in the real world and as it will re-evolve again, you cannot retroactively declare a irredeemable currency to be gold-backed or redeemable by anything. How the currency began in life in the first place. The dollar and all the other currencies at that time during the phase of either the silver standard or the gold standard begin life when a person trusts a financial institution and brings in his money, meaning metal, and gets a piece of paper as evidence of that deposit and the right to redeem it. So it's a deposit. It is people willingly granting credit by handing their money over to a financial institution in exchange for a piece of paper, which is a credit of a financial institution. That's how every currency unit during that entire, you know, period of centuries began its life, as a willing deposit by a trusting depositor and a financial institution. Today, you don't have those conditions, certainly not with the central banks and their currencies. And if that condition existed, I dare, you know, make enemies in this particular room. The conditions are least opposed to that occurring in the United States, and much greater, much farther away from that in places like China and Russia. So in places like China and Russia, first of all, these are murderous dictatorships. There are certain things you just don't say in those places, or they grab you in the middle of the night and they bring you to a dark, damp place where nobody hears your screams. It is illegal. They have capital controls. It is illegal to, if you're a Russian citizen or a Chinese citizen, to dump the ruble or the yuan and trade it for dollars. And yet, I don't know a lot about how it works in Russia. In China, everybody who has any degree of wealth is literally risking his life and torture to dump yuan to buy dollars. That's what the Chinese people do when they see a loophole. They risk their lives. In the United States, I think, and I travel around the world, and I think as an American, I have the right to say this, Americans understand gold the least because our currency has been the most trustworthy for the longest. Everywhere else in the world, either their currencies are yo-yos that go up and down in places like Argentina, or they were never went up in the first place, like a lot of, you know, third world countries. Or in places like Europe, they've had hyperinflation in living memory. And I don't just mean 1923 in Germany, 1956 in Austria, for example. There's a lot of people alive in Europe that remember that. So in the U.S., we don't have anything remotely close to a currency crisis like that. The worst we ever had it was in the late 70s, where inflation was running in high teens type rate. Most of the people in the rest of the world would say, high teens inflation? Oh, that's cute. That's like on a good day in a lot of places in the world. And that was our worst nightmare, which has never recurred. If there was a place in the world where people would willingly make that deposit I'm not sure that a lot of gold people in the U.S. would do it, but less opposition to that in the U.S. than anywhere else. Anyways, I don't think that condition really exists. I think the Fed and the other central banks have squandered whatever trust and goodwill that they've had, and people go along with what the central banks do because they don't have a choice. They've been disenfranchised. They've been dumped into a system. They don't have any choice about it. They don't have any, you know, they don't have any thoughts about how to get out of it either. But you can't retroactively declare these things to be gold-backed. At best, that amounts to a price-fixing scheme. That amounts to a central bank, and we'll use the example of a governor of Banco de República de Banana. And that banco says, or that governor says, our peso is worth $1. Everybody in this call knows exactly what happens and how much time it takes. And the market moves against the bank. And what they have to do in order to maintain this peg that they've declared is they have to increasingly buy their own pesos back and sell dollars until they run out of dollars. Or sometimes when you're playing chess and you realize you're about to lose, you turn your king over on its side. You don't actually have to play it out to the bitter end. You know, the Central Bank of Argentina doesn't squander the very last dollar before they cry uncle and revalue their currency. Sometimes they do it, you know, a year ahead of that inexorable endpoint. But everybody understands you can't maintain a peg. The opposite peg also was attempted. The Swiss National Bank in 2014 and through, I think it started in mid-2013, through 2014, and it failed spectacularly in January 2015. The Swiss National Bank, under Governor or President Thomas Jordan, said that they're going to peg the franc to the euro, but not trying to hold the franc up. It wasn't a banana republic trying to declare their peso to be worth more than it is. They were trying to hold the franc down. Think about that. That they're saying the franc is going up too much in value. This is hurting our exporters, which is wrong, but everybody believes in mercantilism even today. And it's certainly hurting their banks, who have franc-denominated liabilities, which are going up, and euro-denominated assets, which are going down. So I'm sure the banks went to the Swiss National Bank and implored them, do something, hold the franc down. So the Swiss National Bank said, we can hold the franc down. We have unlimited ability because we have the printing press for francs. All we have to do is print as many francs as it takes, and we will hold the franc down to no more than 1.3 francs per euro. And the peg failed spectacularly because, number one, price fixing always fails. Keep that in mind. That's a universal iron law of economics. Price fixing always fails in the end. And the particular failure mode in this case is that the central bank isn't printing, it's borrowing. It is borrowing francs like mad, or was at that time, in order to buy euro-denominated assets. The thing it's borrowing in is going up. Think about it as a pair trade if you're running a hedge fund. The thing you're short is going up and the thing you're long is going down, and you keep increasing your position, doubling down day after day after day. You get to a point where you are staring down the barrel of insolvency. And that's what happened in January 2015. You know, a couple of weeks after this guy said, we stand ready with unlimited printing powers, unlimited resources, whatever his comment was, the peg snapped. It snapped so violently, the Swiss National Bank lost something like 20% of annual GDP in a millisecond. Because if he hadn't given up then, if he hadn't hit a stop loss and was out of the trade, he would have bankrupted the Swiss National Bank, and that would have been a bigger calamity than it was. So price fixing doesn't work. Even if they had the power to do it. And in the case of trying to maintain the price of a commodity by printing and unprinting, that doesn't actually work anyways. And you don't have a depositor base that has deposited gold and willingly in the first place. You have some sort of currency thing. And if you actually stand ready to redeem at that price, then when the market moves against you, it will just simply withdraw all your gold until you're out and then forced to abandon it anyways. So how the heck do you get from here to a gold standard? This is something I've been thinking about and writing about. And I consider myself fortunate to know Judy Shelton and had some discussions with her about this. But I put out what I think is my seminal article on this. It's called Gold Bonds to Avert Financial Armageddon, which I submitted to the Wolfson Prize in 2012. So 10 years ago. And so the Wolfson Prize that year was saying, is there a way for a Euro country to get out of the Euro without calamity and bankruptcy and hyperinflation and all these things? And I said, yeah, here's a way, knowing that, that of course, they would never accept any kind of Austrian economic idea and gold, for that a word. And I was not disappointed. I did not win the prize, but I published the essay anyway. And I said, okay, here's my idea of how you do this. And I absolutely agree that, forget who put it, was it Vince who said, you put gold out on the yield curve. So what I propose in this paper and many times since is that a government, especially currency issuer, should, and I propose this to the U.S. government, I propose this to the state of Nevada, and we were going pretty far along the process. And then the election, the midterm election of 2018 happened, and the Republicans were so badly defeated in Nevada that the Democrats had such a super majority. They said to the Republicans, you don't even need to bother coming into work. We got this. And so, as you can imagine, the Democrats were not necessarily keen on anything gold related. But the idea is pretty simple. You should go and issue a gold bond. Now, not a gold back bond, not a dollar note with some sort of pricing feature that if gold, the dollar payout increases. No, but an actual bond that is denominated in gold and whose principal and interest is paid in gold, period, full stop. You give the bondholders, you pay them gold. Now, if they want to sell it, you know, that's their business. But it's a gold bond. When you sell the gold bond, you're not selling it for dollars. If you simply want to raise more dollars to, feed your welfare state or build, bridges and roads, then sell regular conventional paper bonds. This gold bond doesn't have that as a purpose. You're not selling it for gold. You're not trying to raise, not yet. It's way too early in any kind of reformation of a gold standard. You're not trying to raise gold capital. You're not selling it for gold. And what I propose is one sort of, if you want to call it a trick or an intricacy or a nuance to this, and that is the issuer of the gold bond should say that to bid on this bond, you have to tender how much of our outstanding paper bonds that you will redeem in order to buy this gold bond. So you should start really small because there's a dynamic that's going to develop here. And I'll describe that dynamic. So let's say you start out and you're going to do, 1,000-ounce gold bond. So today, that 1,000-ounce gold bond would be, 1,000 ounces of gold is about $1.8 million. We're not trying to establish a market for the price of gold. That market is already a global market. It's already very liquid, very deep. We know what the price of gold is. Call it $1,800 to make arguments, make the math easy. If you look at a 1,000-ounce bond, you say, okay, well, that should be worth about $1.8 million. And so what you'd expect, par for this course, is that people would tender $1.8 million worth of outstanding, paper bonds to this issuing entity to get this new gold bond that's going to pay $1.8 million worth of gold. But I think very soon, maybe in the first auction, maybe not, it'll take the market a little bit of time to evolve. But very soon, people are going to get to realize, wait a minute, we are essentially being given a choice whether we want to own from the same issuer with the same maturity and the same credit risk. We now have a choice between either owning a bond that is going to pay $1.8 million in 10 years or a bond that is going to pay 1,000 ounces of gold in 10 years. Put yourself in the shoes of that bond buyer. Which would you prefer? The gold bond is obviously a superior instrument. If it's a superior instrument, it should get a superior price. It should command a superior price in the market. And I think that's exactly what's going to happen, is that as we go on with this process, is we should start to establish that paper bonds have an exchange rate with gold bonds at some sort of discount. It's not saying that the dollar trades at a discount to gold. That price is being established every day in a liquid market. Now we're talking out on the yield curve 10 years. It's the paper bond with a 10-year maturity that trades at a discount to the gold bond of 10-year maturity. which means the issuer can get out of debt at a discount, which is a very powerful incentive. So even if the gold price isn't rising, most people are going to think in terms of, well, if the gold price goes up, you could sell the same amount of gold bond to get to replace that much more paper bond. But this is a discount of the paper bond to the gold bond, you know, independent of the price of the dollar against gold and the price of gold against the dollar. And so as this goes on, and especially if other issuers get in the game, which they all have an incentive to do, as long as they have a gold income, to amortize the bond, you need an income. You know, if you buy a house and you have a mortgage, you're not backing that mortgage by having $1 million worth of $20 bills that you hold in a vault in your basement. You amortize that mortgage by having a salary that pays dollars and pays enough dollars to pay the principal and the interest over the maturity of the mortgage. It's the same thing. These are governments that have a gold income, which is any government that has gold mining in its jurisdiction. So that's kind of the core of the proposal. The U.S. government obviously has plenty of gold mining within the U.S. There are a lot of other countries in the world that do, and they can use this should they choose to. That being the key right there, should they choose to, that can begin re-monetizing gold in this way. Now, having said all of that, and having been in pretty deep discussions in one state, which is the state of Nevada, having discussions with a few other states, in the state of Arizona, even though I'm not a member of the legislature, I'm not elected to any office, or appointed for that matter, to any office in the state of Arizona, they made me a member of the Arizona House, formed an ad hoc committee on gold bonds, and ratified my proposal for Arizona. And for a variety of reasons, it didn't move forward. There's very, very little appetite for anything gold related anywhere in the world today. As I said earlier, the Democrats, generally, they hear the word gold and, you know, their sphincters all squeezed shut. And that's it. There's no further consideration given to it. But most of the Republicans are, at best, aggressively indifferent. I recall one meeting in Arizona, and without naming any particular names, the person who was the chair of the subcommittee that was hearing this particular bill, you know, it was a whole discussion for an hour, whatever. Just as they were, the secretary was doing roll call, this person literally ran out of the back of the room, did not want to be on the record as voting. Politically, in Arizona, you had to vote for gold. And every time a gold legal tender bill or gold tax repeal bill came up in Arizona, it passed on strict party lines. At least when it emerged from committee, and then three times vetoed by two Republican governors. Very funny politics around it. The Republicans are kind of aggressively indifferent to it for the most part. The Democrats openly hostile to it. And the same thing occurs around the rest of the world. There's not a lot of friendliness to the idea of a gold monetary standard, certainly not in the West. And I would argue vehemently not in the East either, but for different reasons. The gold standard is the monetary system of a free market. It's for laissez-faire capitalism. And that's the last thing that China and Russia appear to want at the moment. So this emerging gold standard is going to emerge. It has to emerge first among private businesses. It's not going to be governments. They will not be the first adopters or first issuers of this. But there'll come a point, as with Uber, as with so many technologies that change how the world works, that they'll have no choice but to be on board. But that day is not today. However, there are private issuers for whom it makes a great deal of sense to issue gold-denominated debt. And of course, that's the business of, I'm not here to plug my company, but that's the business of what Monetary Metals does. And we have an ever-accelerating, you know, flow of deals where we're doing exactly that. As investors begin to realize they have a choice between either holding paper investments that pay whatever interest rate versus holding gold investments that pay an interest rate in gold, investors begin to express their preference. This is how the world changes. It's one, you know, it changes by a disruptive innovation. So I do agree that gold on the yield curve, if you want to frame it that way, is the way to do it. This is the proposal. This is what we're actually doing right now as a business. All the rest of the stuff is noise. The manipulation. There's one other thing I'll say about manipulation. The manipulation argument is an argument of a dollar thinker who, regardless of whatever he professes to say, he believes in gold, loves gold, thinks the dollar is shit. His complaint is that, damn it, why can't I sell my gold to get more dollars? If only the price would be this, I'd be happy to dump all my gold to get more of those dollars. But just a minute ago, I said we're going to be hyperinflated into worthlessness. But I just want to sell my gold, and that's why I'm obsessed with getting a higher gold price. And my complaint is that the price of gold isn't higher, it's lower. And damn it, that frustrates me.
Couple points, please.
Sure, Jeff.
I'm sorry.
Okay. First of all, I see VBL, I believe his name is Vince, isn't in the room anymore, but I see Chris Marcus is. One point that Vince tried to make, he said, the gold desk is at the bond desk. Well, Chris can, I'm sure, back me up. First of all, they're in two different cities. The bond desk is, in the old days when they had desks on the floor, the bond desk is at the Chicago Board of Trade, and the gold desk is at the COMEX exchange in New York City. So I just wanted to address his point, his inaccurate point, that the gold desk is not at the bond desk for any bank. The banks are big enough, they can afford to have a desk at the COMEX, and they can afford to have a desk at the Chicago Board of Trade. The to visit with Keith a little bit on the manipulation. The manipulation, some people, and I was kind of this opinion myself, I'm a futures broker, I was of the opinion myself that, well, spoofing, it's not that big a deal until you listen to what comes out at the trial, okay? And what comes out at the trial, folks in the room, is that some of these guys, some of these traders, they communicated with other traders. They've got text messages between different desks. They communicated with each other. And why? They wanted to get, maybe the banks are holding stop loss orders, and they wanted to get the price low enough in the stop where they would hit the stop loss orders that would automatically increase the amount of selling. And if you've got a bunch of selling that takes place in a short amount of time, and people have addressed, what about Sunday night at 9:30 or Monday morning at 3 a.m., something like that, at illiquid times, guess what happens? All right, the stops get hit, they run the stops, and the price goes lower. And then the price goes lower into some of these banks resting orders to buy. And if they're buying, they're maybe doing one of two things. They're either buying covering shorts, thereby making a profit, or they are buying covering shorts at the same time going long at the artificially low price that was hit by a bunch of stops. Okay? So some of these spoofing orders, if they put in an order to sell 8,000 or 9,000 or 11,000 contracts at 30 cents above, and if the market started going up, they canceled the order because they didn't really want the order 30 cents above. Their rationale was, we're going to put these spoofing orders in to show that we've got artificial resistance of the market to possibly get them into the stops. If they get them into the stops, either sell stops or buy stops, sell stops cause the market to go lower, buy stops cause the market to go higher. And why would they do this? They did this in a little bit of, with some comrades, they did it so they could benefit from the order, all right, from the price action. That is the textbook definition of manipulation, causing a price to move and benefiting from the move. There's your rationale for spoofing and why they did it and why some of these guys got caught.
So just to add one thing to that, and you mentioned the buy stops, and thank you. They were spoofing in both directions. So this is not a mechanism for holding the price of what it would be at $50,000 down to a mere $1,800. This is a way for them to scalp some pennies. Yeah, they were making money on it. And actually, there was another, was it J.P. Morgan or was it Deutsche Bank? There was a trader convicted, I want to say 2015, but don't quote me on the year. It was some years back. He was convicted of, the bank had sold some sort of option that expired. And so going into the London PM fix, the bank was, actually, it wasn't even using futures. The bank was increased or decreased the amount that it said it wanted to buy at the fix in order to move the fixing price to put their option that they had sold. So they were short the option to make sure that it expired out of the money. And the option was based on the PM fix price. Once the PM fix had printed, the option was out of the money. Then the trader then had to go and actually lost a couple $100,000 closing the position of, you know, buying back all the gold they had sold or selling all the gold they had bought on the fix to get back.
You're right. And there's a bunch of the people in this room that are listening. I'm sure that they watch it every time the options expire and they wonder, why does it tend to gravitate lower at a lower strike price than higher at a higher strike price? And someday, hopefully it'll change. But you're exactly right. It happens.
So anyways, this was the criminal conviction. This is exactly what it was. Now, that was a bespoke option. That was an option based on the PM fixed price. Most Americans would be familiar with, you know, COMEX options or options on GLD or something. And anyways, my point about the Mott and Bailey is that the spoofing cannot, it's not a directional force. And it's also not a strong one.
But
it's not capable of holding something tens of thousands of dollars off of where it should be for decades.
Keith, if there's a three-letter acronym for a bank, we all know who we're talking about. Starts with J. All right. If they've got traders up there and they're at their gold desk and they get this contract, this gold contract, on a Sunday evening or a Tuesday morning early or just at the time that it opens, and they get this gold to move $3 lower. All right, and then let's say they trade 2,000. Okay, so they trade 2,000 contracts. So they spoof this contract to move the price $3 lower. Maybe they were looking for $3. Maybe they're looking for $4 or $5. But when those other, if they know where the stops are because their desk holds the stop loss orders, their traders hold the stop loss orders. All right, so for their customers. All right, so if they move it, let's say $3 and they buy 2,000, okay, all of a sudden now they've got 2,000 contracts long, $3 lower, and by the end of the day, it moves back to $3. Can it move $3 in a day? Well, we closed up today $16.50. That's where we are currently. We actually closed at 5 o'clock for the day. So it's up $15 today, the gold contract I'm talking about. So that's why they did it. They do it like your notion or your opinion is they do it for pennies. Well, they might do it for pennies. They might do it for pennies in silver, like 40 cents or 50 cents in silver. In gold, they do it for dollars. But $3 move on 2,000 contracts, in this example, it's a lot of money. Gold's $100 a dollar, so per contract. So multiply $100 a dollar times $3 times 2,000 contracts. It's a pretty good day's. It's a pretty good hour's work, JP Morgan trader.
Oh yeah, I'm not saying pennies to try to say that it's not an amount of money that anybody should care about. I'm saying that the market's very liquid. If you put in an order $30 away from where the market's currently trading, no one's going to see that, right? So, and you know, gold in the spot market. So one of the graphs we have on our website, and I encourage everybody to take a look, as we update. It's free and we update it every day. As we have a graph of the bid-ask spread in spot gold. Futures, everybody can get that data, but spot's a whole different story. Spot gold used to be 10 cent bid-ask spread. And now, since COVID, things have gotten all kind of messed up and the spreads are a bit wider now, but the spreads are extremely narrow. So to spoof, you probably are talking about pennies in gold and fractions of a penny in silver. Now, on the other hand, the volumes are huge. You know, in London, they're throwing around, you know, one white chip is probably a ton, half a ton to a ton of gold. So it's a lot of ounces. And you're right. If they can do it every day, they can make some. And, you know, for the traders who are doing that, they're personally enriching themselves.
Chris Marcus, I see he's in the room, and I don't know if he wants to sign on as a speaker, but he probably knows off the top of his head what some of these spoofers were charged with. I believe it was like 30,000 or 50,000 times or something like that. They didn't do it three times and get convicted. You know, this was
this is how they did business, and that was the modus operandi for years.
Exactly.
I get that.
That's I'm getting.
But the bigger economic issue, I mean, you know, if you're a trader who was trading against them, that came out of your pocket. I get that. I get why those people would be very upset, why they'd be suing, why they'd be, you know, cheering for the conviction. But the bigger economic issue is, why isn't gold $50,000? Why isn't gold $250 or $300 or whatever, if you inflation adjust silver from 1980?
That's not where the market is, Keith. You're in economics like I am as well. The market dictates where the trade is. today. Gold is $17 at the moment, worth more today than it was yesterday. All right. The dollar is worth less. All right. But it doesn't make it any less painful to have a bank with a floor, with a desk on the floor, okay, in the years past before all this electronic trading, holding, you know, using their influence and using their traders trained by them, by the head honchos, to go out there and game the system. It's illegal, and that's why they were caught.
Yeah, I'm not really defending it. An interesting debate at a separate time is whether there should be regulators as such and what would happen in a truly free market. But the point I'm trying to make is that the macroeconomic issue is we don't have a gold standard. We don't have gold at $50,000 an ounce. Why not? And that was the other thing I was going to say about silver and why silver is trading a bit differently right now than gold and why it often does. Number one, I was on a panel and there was a guy from Metals Focus who spoke right before me. And he was examining the thesis, and he came to the same conclusion that I have from a different direction. A lot of people say silver trades as an industrial metal, industrial commodity. And so he had all the graphs and all the data showing the correlations between silver and copper, silver and oil, and so forth. And then he showed silver, its correlation to gold. And unsurprisingly to me, silver had a very high correlation to gold and not so good a correlation to copper or anything else. So it definitely trades as a monetary metal and not as an industrial ingredient. But I think this is actually one of the big mysteries of economics. And I distinctly recall, so I studied under a guy named Fekete, listening to some of his lectures and hearing something I hadn't really heard anywhere else, which is asking the question, why do we have two monetary metals? They're both very similar. They're both heavy. They're both shiny. One is hard to tarnish. The other really doesn't tarnish. They're dense, they're malleable, they're great reflectors, they're great.
It's the same reason we have a $100 bill, we used to have a $1,000 bill, and we have a
$10. No, that ain't it. Let me finish my story, and if you disagree, you can disagree. That ain't it. Silver is for small change, and gold is for big amounts. Sort of, but that kind of misses the thrust of where I'm going with this. In everything else, it tends to be winner take all. When silver competed against salt, when gold competed against cattle, one wins and the other is completely demonetized and no one ever thinks of cattle again as money as they did back in biblical times. So what is it that you have two? And the answer is each one is the primary money for its particular application. And the way he framed it, which I thought was very elegant, but not terribly clear until you really think it through, gold is great at carrying value over distance. Silver is great at carrying value over time and particularly for the wage earner. So, you know, obviously, given the price of gold, it's not something the average, even skilled, pipe fitter isn't necessarily taking 10% of his weekly wage and buying gold with it. Gold is too expensive for that. Always has been. Gold was for merchant princes and so on, not for wage earners generally. You could save up a lot and get some, but generally those people were dealing in silver. And today, the same thing is true. If you have a skilled tradesman, 10% of his wage might be $50 or $75 or something. If you want to buy $50 or $75 worth of physical gold to take home and put it in the safe under the floor, if you're going to look for a gold product, you're going to pay a very high premium, which you won't necessarily get back when it comes time to sell it. In silver, now, leaving aside that the silver market's completely insane today and that all the 1 ounce silver products have gone completely bananas, which is a whole different set of problems. But in normal times, for $50 or $75, you will face much lower frictional losses, the bid-ask spread. You buy it, and then later, when you know, in retirement, you're selling it by groceries. You will face much smaller frictional losses in the kinds of denominations and kinds of quantities that wage earners are dealing in for silver versus gold.
On futures trades, though, Keith, the spread is the same. It's a half a cent or, you know, a half a dollar or something like that. So they both have very, very narrow spreads. The silver bid ask and the gold bid ask, not at the coin shop, but on the futures exchange.
Yeah, but if you calculate it as a percentage, that 2 or 3 cent spread in silver is actually a greater percentage. It's double to quadruple what gold is.
No, sir. It's not 2 or 3 cents. I'm talking about in silver, it's like a half a cent bid-ask spread on a contract. So if it's if it's traded, if the last trade is 1839, okay, it's 1838 and a half bid, 1839 and a half ask. It's a half a cent. Day in and
day. Hang on a second, I'm pulling up my graph right now. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm looking at spot. You're right. And spot, it is 2 to 3 cents in silver right now. Last time I looked at futures was a while ago, but even there, it's a wider spread as a percentage than gold because it's a less liquid market. But anyways, I'm talking about 1 ounce. I'm talking about the denominations that one would buy if one had $50 to put into precious metals. How much is $50 worth of silver? You know, 2-3 ounces. How much is $50 worth of gold? Small fraction of an ounce. The bid-ask spread on a small fraction of an ounce gold product, you can get gold bars easily down to 1 gram. You can even get a tenth of a gram if you go in, you know, to Turkey and Malaysia and places like that. But the spreads are just huge on that amount. The other thing is, and I think this is kind of an emotional, visceral thing that people are emotional, holding $50 worth of silver in the hand is satisfying. There's a certain heft to it. Holding $50, that little gold fleck of $50 in your hand has no satisfaction. It's not satisfying at all.
It just depends on how big a buyer or how small a buyer you are.
Okay. 10% of the weekly wage of a working class person. I'm specifically defining that context because that is historically who was the owner of silver. And I think even so today, the stackers are stacking silver because they can't afford to stack gold. And so that's the difference between how gold trades and how silver trades. Gold's a capital asset being traded by the capital class. Silver is something that is accumulated. And somebody early on the call, I think it was Vince, was talking about today, who's buying silver? It's the retail stackers. And who's selling, you know, who's buying gold, who's selling gold? Well, there's a lot of gold buying right now, and there's a lot of gold selling for other reasons. But gold and silver are trading differently right now. And gold is not anywhere near a backwardation. Silver is in backwardation, and not just in year months. It's spreading to other months. And that's because silver is more of a retail, again, the physical, you know, the 1 ounce products is very much more of a retail, you know, play versus gold. Anyways, I'm going to have to jump in a couple of minutes. So if anybody has any questions, I can't see my screen right now either, but happy to answer a few, and then I have to jump.
Okay, thanks, Keith.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.